Watching athletes who have devoted their lives to being the best in the world is really inspiring, and it can be a great motivation to get moving. But when we do, we want to be sure we do it right so we don't get sidelined before we really even get started. We're lucky that once a month, Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody come by to share their knowledge and experience with us. Bill Boisenault is associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic of the UW Hospitals and Clinics. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Pleasure as always.
And Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the graduate program director for the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Great to see you, Lori.
Good to be back.
And we're especially happy to have Bill since he was winging his way back to Wisconsin this morning and driving back from Milwaukee. So
within the speed limit.
Of course.
We're close to it anyways.
Of course. We would expect nothing less of you, Bill.
Thank you, Judith. I appreciate that.
Sure. Well, you know, as we were saying, you know, a lot of us have enjoyed watching the Olympics just closed yesterday. I know there are some sports that I make a point of watching, but then I would get sucked into watching others that I really didn't even know much about. But just the passion of the athletes, I think, is such a draw. What kind of care does it take to keep those athletes healthy and hopefully injury-free during such intense workouts and performances, Lori?
Oh, it takes a broad range of things. I mean, they're very well tuned and very well cared for. They're usually overseen by the specialists, the coaches, and athletic sports medicine staff with their governing body, their sport governing body, or the U.S. Olympic Committee. And so they have an entire structure in place for nutrition, for coaching, for injury, where they have, you know, the top people in their field optimizing their performance. So there are physical therapists, there are athletic trainers, there's coaches, there's nutritionists, there's chiropractors, there's physicians, all of them working as a team to make sure that that athlete is in their very best shape mentally and physically for the games.
Yeah,
is that
full-time job plus?
I bet.
And many times injuries don't happen during the competition itself, but during the training. It's the repetition of the training that can get some folks into trouble.
And what about other countries? I mean, is that a pretty similar structure in other places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, in other countries, it is more professionalized and sanctioned and supported by the government. Here, it is not really a government-supported activity. The government doesn't provide, you know, housing and care for these. It's more a function of the governing body of that sport that takes care of those athletes.
You were talking about it being the repetition in the training that often leads to injury. Are there certain injuries that are really common in particular sports disciplines?
Oh, sure. I mean, you could go through and just think about sports, you know, basketball, soccer, football are classic for knee injuries, ACL injuries, ankle sprains, things like that. Gymnastics have a high number of spine injuries and hip injuries and wrist and hand injuries. So you just look at the demands of the sport and you can pretty much see swimmers have shoulder problems.
Shoulders, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes knee and low back problems. So you can take a look at the biomechanics of the sport, and that's what biomechanists do, sports biomechanists. They look at the mechanics of the activity and try to find ways to minimize the stress on those joints.
Mm-hmm. I know when people are training, say, for a marathon or any kind of endurance event like that, often the conventional wisdom is to give yourself quite a bit of rest leading up to the event. Do Olympic athletes do that too, or is there this pressure to just train every last possible minute?
Well, it's their training is focused in cycles. I mean, they call them, you know, microcycles, mesocycles, mini cycles. They break down the 4-year cycle between Olympics into one big block, and they take that big block and they break it down into smaller blocks with, you know, world competitions and other national and international competitions in between. And they have times where they ramp up and ramp down, and they will taper to the Olympics.
Mm. Right.
So they kind of look at that whole calendar and
right.
They're probably already planning ahead 4 years from now in Rio.
Right. Exactly.
Or many of these sports.
Exactly.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And I'm guessing that there are folks that, after watching the games, either decide to try a new sport or maybe get back into one that they haven't played for a while. What do we need to keep in mind if we're starting to use our bodies in different ways? Lori?
Well, there are a number of things. The first thing is to make sure that the infrastructure is in place to do it. So you say, okay, I'm going to go play in a rec basketball league this winter. You know, you need to make sure that your joints are ready to do that. So preconditioning your joints with some kind of hopping or impact loading activity. Along with that, your muscles have to be able to absorb the loads and shocks of that. So you need a strength training program. So really the first phase, again, if you look at competition and cycles, the first phase is building your infrastructure, strength, flexibility, balance, impact loading, and kind of specifically defined skills. And then you progress that into the sport itself slowly.
So you're basically kind of taking the building blocks to get to where you want to go.
It's more than just starting to get into shape, and then I'll start playing basketball. That's when you're setting yourself up for injuries to occur. And transitioning, you know, the first time you're on the court shouldn't be in a full court game.
Mm-hmm.
So you start doing some drills. You start playing two-on-two a little bit and kind of work your way up. Some of the people that I see with back problems who are golfers, you know, I don't tell them to go out to do 18 holes the first day out, but go to the driving range first and use the irons first. And if that goes well, then start using your woods. Then maybe do a par three before you get back out on the 18 holes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, high-level athletes don't have necessarily the time to afford to take that many steps with the transition, but you know, that seems to work for lots of people who aren't necessarily driven by that time frame.
And I know we always want people to get active and, you know, keep moving and things like that. We want them to do it healthily. Is there a point where maybe we're just not meant to play soccer anymore, or maybe we shouldn't be running around a basketball court?
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
not to put a damper on any of that enthusiasm.
You need to match the sport to your physical capabilities and, you know, your joint structure. We've been talking mostly from a musculoskeletal perspective, you know, joints, bones, muscles, things like that. You know, but there's also the medical side of it. For example, my son and I did this bike ride across Iowa at the end of July. And on the second day, I encountered a gentleman in his 50s who was calling his wife to come and get him because he was having hypoglycemia and he was not stable with his diabetes. He had been told by his physician and by his wife not to do the ride because his diabetes wasn't stable. He had recently been diagnosed, but he decided he wanted to do it anyway. So making sure that from all aspects of your physical health, you know, if you're older, starting with a trip to your physician for a physical and a checkup and kind of seeing sort of what the boundaries are and what you should take on.
And then actually listening to them.
And then, yes, listening. Yes.
Following directions.
Following directions.
What a novel
you know,
idea.
Or if you're not going to listen to the doctor, listen to your wife.
Listen to your spouse. That's right.
I would agree with that.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. They are the physical therapists that generously and genuinely spend their time with us once a month to help with injury questions and all kinds of topics of use to all of us. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave Potraz, our on-air producer today, waiting to take your call. And let's go to Jan in Green Bay. Hi, Jan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just got a little question, a little injury. I've had it, I guess, majority of the summer, and it's like on the inside of my left knee, and that's just it, right on the bone. And I run about 20 miles a week. In fact, I just got done doing 6. And it really doesn't bother me too much, except like when I sleep at night, I sleep on my side and I rest my other leg on top of it. And then it really kind of bothers me, the soreness, but it's right on the left knee on the inside, right on the bone. I was wondering if there anything that I'm doing to it or I could do to it that would help at all.
Are you having any pain when you run?
No, I just, like I said, I just got done doing 6, and I really don't have any pain when I'm running at all. Something did pop up the last week or so ago. I'm having a little bit on my other side. I'm having a little bit with a hamstring and a glute. Just, you know, one of those things where you, like, That's not quite right.
Right.
You know, I can run, but it's...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, the most common thing on the inside of your knee is some arthritis. Are your legs pretty straight, a little bowed leg and a little knock-kneed?
They're pretty straight. I'm looking at them right now.
Okay. As people who are a little bowed-legged tend to have more problems on the inside of their knee. You know, but the most common thing is a little bit of arthritis on the inside of your knee, and especially when it touches something else right on that bone.
Yeah.
And you can have a little bit of tendonitis on the inside, but it's not as common.
Okay.
And it makes me wonder if, even though you don't feel it when you run, you're subtly changing what you do a little bit because you're starting to get symptoms on the other side. So I'd say, you know, given that you enjoy running so much, I'd go in and have it looked at.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have sort of your whole lower extremity biomechanics analyzed, looking for leg length differences, differences in your gait, abnormalities in your gait. Bring your running shoes in so they can take a look at the wear pattern on your shoes.
Okay.
And see if you have any imbalances or asymmetries that are contributing to these problems. And they can give you some recommendations on some exercises to do or maybe some subtle modifications to your gait when you run to minimize those loads.
Yeah, and in the meantime, for sleeping, if you haven't tried to put pillow between your knees,
yeah,
it'll just add some padding. And
That helps. Yeah, that helps. A lot of times I'll just bunch up the top blanket or something and stick that in between.
There you go.
And
yeah,
that helps and stuff. And I have like two or three pairs of running shoes I kind of rotate through.
Okay, that's so a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah, that is. But, you know, one of the, again, this is, sometimes it's hard to go in and see somebody when you can still do what you like to do.
Yeah.
But if you wait, you know, then it just gets harder to sort out what came first, the chicken and egg deal, and it gets a little harder to get over it. So I think if you go in now and kind of tweak stuff before things get out of control, you're going to be better off.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Jan. And speaking of running, Jane commented on Facebook, I see many physical makeover shows that have morbidly obese folks running. I, too, am overweight and prefer walking. Isn't running before your body is in a more healthy range dangerous? What are your opinions? Lori, do you want to start?
That's a really good question. Well, in terms of your knees, every pound of body weight is 2 to 3 pounds excess across your knee joint with every step you take. So starting in an activity where you have both feet on the ground at all times makes sense from a musculoskeletal point of view. So I would agree with that. That being said, one of the things about walking is you really have to ramp up the intensity. If you're trying to lose weight, walking at your normal pace is probably not intense enough to have any kind of strengthening or weight loss impact or any kind of significant one. You really have to up the speed. So I'd still try to stay on a trail if I could, because as you increase the speed, even with both feet on the bottom, you increase the loads on your joints. So I'd still try to stay on a little bit softer surface like a trail or a track if I could. And then I would try to increase the intensity. And it may be that you walk for 2 blocks or a quarter mile or whatever, however you mark your distance at your usual pace. And then you speed up for 30 or 40 seconds or 60 seconds, and then you slow back down again, and then you speed up again, and you do this sort of speed play. And that's a way to up the intensity gradually.
And also, on a treadmill, you can also increase the incline pretty easily, and that's a nice soft surface,
too. Yeah, it's a soft surface. It goes into our discussion right at the beginning of the show of transitioning to a new activity. And if your goal is to run and you've never run and weight is an issue, you probably shouldn't start with running. You tolerate fast walking, and then you can jog and walk. You can start mixing that in and reach the goals of losing weight and getting in better shape, especially the knees in particular and hips as well.
Really, and you have to think about physical activity along a continuum from, you know, not very much to very intense like Olympic athletes. And what people do is they try to decide where to jump in along that continuum. And if you jump in at too high a level, then you risk A, getting injured, and B, it just being too hard and uncomfortable and you don't sustain it.
And unpleasant.
And unpleasant, exactly.
Yes.
Which, you know, most of us are not gluttons for punishment. So. We're talking with physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And we are at 3,999 fans on Facebook right
wow.
now.
It would be the next one.
Exactly. It would be lovely for Larry to come back tomorrow and see us well over 4,000. So if you haven't liked the Facebook page, please do. I'm Judith Sears Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. We are talking with physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, and we have several people waiting to join the conversation. So let's go right back to the phones and Janet in La Crosse. Hi, Janet.
Hello. I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
Hey, thank you. I have been dealing with hip bursitis for like a year and a half. Have been to physical therapy, gotten ultrasound and massage. I've been doing exercises. I'm using a foam roller. Better, but I'm still having pain. So, especially after being on my feet for like an hour or so. I have a long-time history of scoliosis and have low back pain with that, which I deal with massage and exercises. So my questions are, how do I get back to biking? Because I want to do that, but I'm a little nervous that I'm going to get out there and be miserable. Is there any relationship between scoliosis and hip and thigh pain? Or should I be focusing more on the bursitis? Any suggestions?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question. 18 months is a really long time. There is a connection between the low back in particular and the pelvis and hips. But having said that, there are lots of people with scoliosis who have no symptoms or have back pain only. So one does not necessarily have to be tied to the other. The fact you've had this for 18 months, and it sounds like they've done lots of things locally around that hip area. Out over that bursa, it's a common referral spot for pain from the lumbar spine. So over the last 18 months, Janet, has anybody really examined your back, your low back, mid-back area in detail?
Not in detail.
Okay.
I mentioned it to my physical therapist, and that was probably 6 months ago. And she wasn't real sure, I guess, thought, well, maybe, but she thought we were still probably more dealing with bursitis.
Okay. All right. Well, so part one, that would be my recommendation, is to either go back to the same physical therapist or whoever else you would go to and have them do a detailed exam of your low back. Sometimes it helps a little bit if you go in with some discomfort in that area, because one of the goals of the exam then is to alter the pain, hopefully make it better, maybe a little bit worse, to help you decide exactly where is it coming from. So just from the source of pain, it might be your lumbar spine and not necessarily your hip.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the other connection between the scoliosis, this excessive lateral curvature causing hip problems, it does. It can throw off your posture.
Mm-hmm. That it does.
And so it throws off how you stand and how you walk. So there can be a link where indirectly what's going on in your back can be causing the hip discomfort. But like as I said, there's a lot of people with scoliosis who have no hip pain at all. And biking, you mentioned you have pain with when you're on your feet for an hour and a half. Have you tried biking at all in the last 6 months?
Just a little bit, just around the neighborhood.
And how did your hip and back do with that?
Well, fine, but I don't go out when I'm having pain.
Okay. All right. All right. So do you know for sure the biking makes the pain worse?
I think this whole thing with the bursitis started because that winter I was doing a lot of stationary bike.
Okay.
And when I talked to my physical therapist about it, she thinks it was because I was leaning forward a lot, that my posture wasn't good on the bike.
Yeah.
Which might have contributed to the problem.
Okay. All right. Well, those are my thoughts. I would have somebody take a good look at your low back as a possible source of pain, and then they can also work with you. They can put you on a bike and have you pedal and watch your posture and see how you do symptomatically, because the biking without the pounding could be a good exercise for you.
Janet, do you know if the scoliosis produces a functional leg length difference
yes,
for you?
Yes, it does. It's very slight.
Okay, but
it's
so
a very slight curvature, but it's, yeah.
So you have a lift?
You
don't have a lift in your shoe?
No.
You know, that might be something you could try. So, you know, sometimes an activity like biking is enough to stir it up, and typically the little leg length difference you have wouldn't manifest at all. But then once you get things stirred up, then the leg length difference can perpetuate it. So it's just another possibility. That's a pretty easy trial.
Okay. Yeah.
See if that helps.
Yeah, it might be worth it. Because I do notice, I mean, this is really, the pain on the left side of my back is worse. So it's definitely one-sided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe you might
try that once and just see how far that gets you.
Great. Thanks for that call, Janet. And let's go next to Katie in Wausau. Hi, Katie.
Hi. My question is also about my hips. I've been running for several years, and I recently got a job where I stand all day long. I don't walk or anything. I just stand there. And now when I go running, my hips are just killing me. And so I was wondering if you had any suggestions on what I could do, if there were like shoes or exercises or something I could try.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the job and how long? Is this going to be a permanent job or is this a temporary job? And what kind of surface are you on?
It's going to be temporary. It's a hard surface. I'm cashiering.
Oh, okay. Yeah, cashiering is very tough. You know, I guess my recommendations for people who are cashiering are if there's not a mat, kind of a rubber mat where you're standing, to get that, to make sure you're wearing shoes that are very supportive and comfortable. And then when you're standing, to the best of your ability, I would do a lot of weight shifting side to side and try to avoid static standing with your weight equally distributed on both legs for long periods of time. So the more you can shift around and move around, the better, because that lubricates your joints. And then if you can convince your boss to get you a tall stool so that you can offload sometimes, that's useful as well.
Do you have any suggestions as to what I should look for when you said comfortable shoes?
Well, you know, taking a look at your foot posture, if you have a pretty normal foot posture, a shoe that provides good support to your arch and some shock absorption so that every time you shift your weight, you're not getting all the ground forces from that hard floor back up through your joints. You know, I'd be looking at my posture when standing, you know, trying to do some pelvic tilts and some tucking around my pelvis. When you have a lunch hour or a break, I'd get out and walk, although your inclination is to get off your feet a little bit, but just to move and lubricate your joints and stretch a little bit, and then maybe getting on a strengthening program for your core.
All right.
Okay. Is that something that orthotics would help, do you think, or not so much?
Oh, only if you have an abnormal foot posture. If you have a normal foot posture, then orthotic wouldn't help.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks for that call, Katie. And let's go right to Darcy in Cass City, Michigan, who also has a foot issue. Hi, Darcy.
Hi. Thank you for letting me call in.
Sure.
My question is, no matter what kind of exercise that I do, I was in aerobics and doing Zumba, and my feet were fine when I was doing the exercises. But afterwards, when I have been sitting for a while or after when I get up in the morning, when I put my feet on the floor, oh, my goodness, my feet would hurt so bad, and it would take so long to get to the point where they stopped hurting. So then I stopped doing that for a while until my feet felt better, and then I started speed walking and interval running, and I was going, you know, I worked up till 5 miles a day, and my feet got so bad again. The same exact thing, where they don't hurt while I'm running, they don't hurt while I'm exercising, but if I'm resting, like sitting at my computer or when I'm sleeping and I get up in the morning, I can hardly walk on them until it, like, does something and finally gets to the point where they're not hurting so bad. So I'm just wondering, and I tried all different types of shoes, orthotics. I can't seem to figure out what's going on.
Have you been to see anybody about it?
Well, I had been going to a foot doctor for other things. You know, I had some fungus on my toenails, and so I went to a foot doctor for that. He didn't say there was anything wrong with my feet. I have an excellent arch. I've always been athletic-oriented, so I've never had any health issues. I'm, you know, vegetarian and real healthy. I eat real healthy.
And where, where does your foot hurt?
The whole bottom of both feet. Well, just, like, I can barely walk it. Like, I've pulled all the muscles in the bottom of my feet.
Right.
And it feels like.
And is it worse first thing in the morning?
Yep, first thing in the morning, or if I've been sitting for a while, and then as I walk on them and I have to work it up, and I can just be sitting for 5 minutes and think, so I haven't been exercising because I'm afraid for my feet to get like that again. If I stop exercising, the problem goes away. But if I exercise, the problem comes back.
Yep. Let's see what Lori says.
Yep, well, I think you need to get in to see somebody. It sounds a little bit like plantar fasciitis, and there are a number of interventions that can be used for plantar fasciitis. And many times people look at their arch and they say, I've got a normal arch, and it looks that way non-weight bearing. But when you stand and you look at it from the back, you can see some problems with your arch. So there could be a number of issues that are contributing to it, but it sounds a little bit like plantar fasciitis. And there are a number of things that you can do to treat that. So I'd get in to see a good physical therapist who has expertise in foot and ankle, and they should be able to help you manage this problem because it shouldn't keep you out of exercise.
I know. That's the thing is, you know, I just love to exercise, and I find myself avoiding it because I don't want to get my feet back in that position.
Exactly.
That's the problem that's exacerbated by exercise is what you're saying.
Right.
All right. Thanks
well,
for
thank
the
you very much.
Thanks, Darcy. And let's go to Bruce in Mineral Point. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, I'm soon to be 60 years old. I'm a carpenter, so I'm on my feet all day, and I play recreational softball quite a bit in the summer. I have knee pain, and not debilitating, but I was wondering what benefit arch supports would be to me because I am flat-footed.
Well, it you could certainly give it a try. You know, again, if you went in and saw a physical therapist and they could examine your biomechanics of your lower extremity, one of the things you can do is if you're looking straight ahead in a mirror and you look at the alignment of your hips, knees, and feet, and if keeping your toes in the ground, you kind of lift up your arch and you see an improvement in the angle that your knee makes with your hips and feet, then you say, yeah, you'd probably benefit from an arch support. So the question is whether or not your knee problems are the result of the biomechanical problems from your feet, or if they're a result of kneeling and doing stairs and things like that. And I don't know that anybody can sort out the answer to that question. But if you wanted to do a trial, you could, you know, go to any drugstore and get an over-the-counter arch support. And I would try them in the evenings and weekends, wearing them around the house or for your recreational activities where you could take them in and out if they get uncomfortable and see how you feel. But I wouldn't just throw them in my shoes and start going about all my activities because the change in your biomechanics could cause some problems.
Bill, did you want to add anything?
Nope. That's all I would start as well. Start with something that's relatively inexpensive and you can fabricate easily. And if that seems to help some, then you can go from there.
Yeah, you can step it up. And you don't necessarily have to have a custom. You can go to a higher quality and you can get those at many stores like REI or other sporting goods stores that have the arch supports that are in the $30 to $40 range.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. Good luck with that. And you can join the conversation with physical therapists Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne-Brody by calling 1-800-642-1234. We have some open lines. That's 800-642-1234. On Facebook, David asked, could you explain the recovery process after microfracture surgery of the talus stone? I was on crutches for 5 1/3 weeks. Now I'm down to one crutch. Any strength training ideas?
Well, a microfracture is done in the presence of arthritis, and what they try to do is stimulate a healing response to lay down fibrocartilage to create a new joint surface. So a couple issues about that. The tissue that generally replaces the existing tissue isn't very good. It can do pretty well if you keep your weight down. So I would say avoiding overweight, gaining too much weight, keeping your weight down would be really important. strengthening exercises for the core, around the hips and knees, so that they can absorb some of the shock with every step, wearing good supportive shoes, and avoiding a lot of impact. Obviously, I would suggest that he see a physical therapist and be guided through this process, because the other thing he wants to have is as much range of motion as possible. Mm-hmm. That way, as he walks and goes through the range, those loads can be distributed over a larger area of the Taylor Dome and not focused on one specific area because he has a loss of range of motion. That will really overload that healing tissue. Mm-hmm. So the slow progression to increased weight bearing, and then watching his weight, watching any static standing is also going to be hard for it. Anytime you have an arthritic joint that doesn't like static standing, it's going to like to be moved. So just keeping that in mind as he chooses his recreational activities.
Yeah, working with a PT will be really helpful, and over some time for David, I'm not sure what his usual activity level is, but Lori's right. He needs more than strengthening. Mm. He needs to really follow the weight-bearing guidelines, but it'll be balance work, it'll be flexibility, as well as strength. And not just locally in that mm-hmm. ankle area.
So really a holistic approach.
Yes, very much so.
Great. And we had an email from Dan. He would love to hear thoughts on a tight IT band, what negative effects it might have on the body, and great ways to stretch them. Bill?
Well,
what is the IT band, first of all?
Well, the iliotibial band, it's a muscle tendon that runs from the hip and crosses the knee, mm-hmm. kind of the outside of the knee.
Okay.
And it can cause problems with lots of runners and walkers and climbers. It can be very debilitating. And once it gets stirred up, like many of the other tendinopathies we've talked about or bursitis issue that people has, it throws off how you stand and how you walk. And it can set you up to have problems at the knee and the lumbar area as well. It's more than just focusing on the IT band itself. People can use a foam roller or a tennis ball to do a deep massage to work some of the knots out of that mm-hmm. muscle, and then there's some ways to stretch it. But really, core strength, any muscle imbalances around the hip, tightness or weakness at other muscle groups will mean the IT band is working harder than mm-hmm. it should. So it's more than just one muscle that needs to be addressed to really recover from this long term.
All right. And let's go back to the phones and Chris in Milwaukee next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 26-year-old, and for the last year or more, I've had pain in my right shoulder while throwing, in the throwing motion.
Mm-hmm.
It typically only happens when I'm trying to throw far, like a baseball or a football. I believe it's the weight pulling back on my arm in the windup, because like when I play volleyball, it won't hurt when I hit the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious what would be causing that, and also if this is related, because recently my arm starts popping while walking, so just like the normal sway, my shoulder, I can feel it pop on the way forward.
Mm-hmm. And you're
so
right-handed?
I am, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if those are related or...
They're possibly related. One of the things that we see with throwers is some instability, and that could account for the popping. And it's typically when you, as you suggested, when you get in the wind-up position, that's the position where your shoulder wants to either sublux or dislocate out the front. And we see this is a chronic problem in shoulder. So, when you start asking at the beginning of the show, certain injuries with certain sports, yes, throwing sports, you're going to have problems with instability and your rotator cuff. So I'd go in to have this looked at, and have your shoulder examined to see if you do have either some subtle or some frank instability. And they can get you on an exercise program to help deal with that. They can look at how you throw and help you modify how you throw so that you don't increase the instability that you might have. And they might direct you to appropriate activities given the state of your shoulder. A rotator cuff strengthening program, stabilization exercises will all help this.
Okay.
So you're young, so you have a lot of years to get out of that shoulder yet. So I'd go in and get this looked at before you have something like a frank dislocation
right.
at some point.
Okay. And Chris, when you go in, they should also, focus on your shoulder, but they should mm-hmm. also be looking at your neck and your upper back as well, along with the core stabilization work. flexibility, improve flexibility through the chest, upper back, and neck, and take stress off that shoulder, can help with the recovery process and help prevent things from coming back again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. Good luck with that. And Pete emailed, what amount of leg length discrepancy can be ignored and what amount should be addressed with a lift or some other kind of orthotics for physical activity or cashiering or other slightly mobile work?
Well, that's a great question. The first thing that should be said about leg length discrepancies is that the measurement error, you know, if you go into a clinic and you have me measure your leg length, there's a tremendous amount of error in that measurement. So when you go in and you see your healthcare provider, one person says, oh, you have a half inch leg length difference. And the person says, well, geez, I don't see one. You know, that's a measurement error. So you just have to take that with a grain of salt to begin with.
How do you measure it, actually?
Well, in a clinic, what you do is you start at the hip bone. You know, if you have the person lying their back and those pointy hip bones that you have in front, you find the very tip of that.
Okay.
And you measure with a tape measure to the very tip of the inside of your ankle bone. Mm-hmm. So already you have error in someone figuring out, well, where's the tip? So usually repeated measurements help on one day or over a series of days helps improve the reliability of that measurement. So you have to understand that the measurement isn't exact to start with. So, you know, thereafter, we kind of look at it symptomatically. You know, sometimes if you have even a half inch leg length difference, which would be significant, if you go and you put a lift in that shoe, you could actually create more problems. So you put that piece of information together with all the other information that you collect during your exam, both subjective and objective, to determine whether or not it makes sense to put a lift in. Usually something like a quarter inch, that's so well within measurement error
right.
that you don't really put a lift in unless you've tried all your other interventions and you're not making any traction. Then you say, well, let's give this a try. Mm-hmm. I've had people you put a lift in and they think that the sun rises and sets over your head because it fixed all their problems. Mm-hmm. Other people can create problems, so you just have to be careful.
Yeah. As when I notice a difference, as part of the exam, I'll partially correct a leg length and then have people bend or twist mm-hmm. and move and say, how does it feel, along as what does it look like to me? And if they look like they're moving better and they're feeling better, I'm going to have them put something in their shoe. And you don't want to fully correct it. Because as Lori mentioned, the body has adjusted to this leg length discrepancy forever, probably.
Sure.
And so if you put too much of lift in, then you can cause other problems. So it's part of a trial treatment. You know, you partially correct it, watch them move, watch them walk. What do their symptoms feel like compared to when it wasn't in that shoe? And if they move better and feel better, that's going to be part of their home program.
And do most of us have perfect leg length, or does everyone have a little bit of a difference?
Probably a degree. We all have some.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's a judgment call. Like Lori said, there's the measurement error is considerable, and but so really it comes down to the symptoms and then trying to partially correct it and see how they look and feel.
Sure. All right. Let's go to Patty in Wausau. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I tuned in late and just heard the tail end of the woman who was speaking of having scoliosis and hip problems.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, who's 16, has a lower curvature in her spine, about 17 degrees, and she has also a leg length difference, and she has a lot of hip problems. And she's had them for about 2 years, and she's a swimmer. And it turns out that for a long time we thought it was bursitis. But it turns out that it's actually, they discovered tendonitis. And she's got a tendon that's kind of snapping over something in her leg, I'm not sure. But she ended up having steroid injections in her bursa sac to reduce the swelling and the irritation. And she's doing much, much better now. She doesn't have near as much hip pain as she had before. I just thought I'd mention that for that woman who seems to be going through quite a, you know, a lot of difficulty here for a long time.
Yeah, I would agree. That came to mind, but we didn't mention it. And typically over the course of 18 months, if she's being managed by a physician, someone has entertained a cortisone injection. So if it is truly bursitis, The injection can be diagnostic in that it helps you isolate that that is where the problem is coming from, and the cortisone can help beat back the inflammation so that the exercises have a chance to help. Sometimes we just can't get ahead of the inflammation, so the cortisone injection can be very helpful.
Yeah, and I think what Lori said is the key. The injection, if it works, is just really the start. It should open some doors for rehabilitation to start addressing. So why did this begin in the first place? Was it starting a new activity or changing the intensity of an activity? There may be some underlying muscle imbalances or, you know, core strength deficits that now can be addressed because the injection has helped symptomatically.
Right, and that's what we're seeing with my daughter. She's a swimmer, and she doesn't have a whole lot of got a lot of strength in her front but not in her back, which is what caused the problem. So now that she's kind of beaten the pain, she can now start to work on proper swimming form and improving her core strength and everything, which has helped quite a bit.
So
I just thought I'd mention that for her.
Great. Thanks so much, Patty. We always appreciate when callers can help out other callers. Mm-hmm. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. We are talking with physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault. Did you watch the Olympics? Did you get bitten by the sports bug, or are you content to just sit back and watch? And is there a sport you'd like to try, but you don't know if you're in good enough shape? Bill and Lori can answer those and many more questions when you join the conversation. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Tomorrow at 11, Larry is back, and we'll be talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine about keeping our pets happy and healthy. And keeping us happy and healthy today are Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. They are physical therapists that come by once a month to answer questions and offer advice. And I'd say let's go right back to the phones and Dan, who is on the road. Hi, Dan.
Oh, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Great.
Good.
Well, first and foremost, I'd like to mention that gal with the possible fasciitis in her foot there. I have the same thing, and I just spend a lot of time looking for shoes. Style comes second.
Yes.
Feel comes first. You know, I really like the style, but right now I have a set of Reeboks that the sole consists of dozens of little nubs instead of one solid heel, and them things work awesome for me. Otherwise, New Balance and ASICS have worked awesome, and I haven't had a problem, and I run miles every day. So
good for you.
So I not saying not to go to the doctor. I skipped that option just because I knew what it was and went straight to the shoe store and spent about an hour looking for a pair of shoes. If it didn't feel right, I didn't get them.
Yeah.
Second off, my daughter, she's 10 years old, and since birth she has had a knee pain that comes and goes. It seems to come with activity, but not always. But it's just almost like a growth pain, but I don't want to call it that because it's not really in it around any time of growth period. But all of a sudden, her knee will just explode with pain, and I'm talking, you know, crying, drooling, throwing up pain. I mean, just pain that makes her want to keel over. The Motrin seems to take it away, but I mean, sometimes it comes right in the middle of the night. Sometimes it comes. We've had a doctor look at it, and they don't really have a whole lot of anything to offer, and I don't know what I can do to get this diagnosis. It's just a come and go, and it, like I said, it seems to come with activity. After a heavy day of activity, maybe at night she'll have it, but like I said, it's not always attributed to that.
How often does she get this pain?
Lately, not as often, but, I mean, it could be sometimes a couple times a week, sometimes every 2 or 3 months. But it is just excruciating pain.
And do you notice swelling or redness or anything else?
There's a possibility there might be. I mean, most of the time we're so frantic and just trying to get the pain to go away. But like I said, she is just screaming in agony, and it comes on slowly. I mean, they'll just like, you know, my knee's starting to hurt, Dad, and then, you know, well, okay, well, if we're out and about, we're like, okay, we'll find a Walgreens to get some medication, and within 5 minutes, just screaming in the back seat.
Yeah. You know, I would continue to pursue this from the medical perspective. If she's seen her primary care physician, you could see the sports people. The other thing to consider is when she has one of these episodes where the pain is so bad, drive her to the urgent care
right.
and have somebody look at her when she's in pain. It's really hard to diagnose a problem like that when she's not hurting. So I think taking her in when she's in that much pain and they can see her and they can examine her at that moment is going to give you the best information.
It might really add to their understanding of how really serious this
That's
is
exactly
for her.
What I was thinking too.
Yeah.
You probably get a bigger bang for your buck that way, Dan.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'll do that. Thank you very much.
And definitely give us a call back some other month when Bill and Lori are on and let us know how that's going.
Yeah. That's an unusual presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
And she has no other joints that bother her?
No, none.
Okay.
I believe it's just one knee.
Yeah.
I think it's that right knee, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're so frantic, it's hard to remember which knee, but I'm pretty sure it's just the one knee.
Yeah.
I'll definitely
I'd have her in one next time she has one. I'd just drive her right to the urgent care.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck with that, Dan. And as a parent, that must be
frightening.
Really tough.
Yeah.
Really awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not knowing what's going on.
Right. On Facebook, Roberta asks, what do you advise for the treatment of a chronic groin pull? I do spinning and yoga, and just as it's going away, I seem to do something that aggravates it.
Well, I guess the first question, and we don't have her on the line, so we can't answer that, is it really a groin strain? Was there any kind of injury? You know, usually it's a leg splitting kind of injury that creates a groin pull. So typically
doing the splits
or something like that. I don't know if she did something during yoga and that pulled it. So the question is whether or not there's clearly a defined injury so we know it's a groin strain, because all kinds of other things can cause groin pain. It can be something where the muscles attach to the bone, like a tendinopathy. It can be a problem with her pubic bone itself. It can be osteoarthritis in her hip. It could be
a stress fracture.
A labral tear. It could be a stress fracture. Exactly. Right. It could be any of those things. So I'd say in the absence of a clear cause of the hip pain, I'd go in and have it looked at to make sure that you're dealing with a groin pull.
Right.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Ron in Norwalk. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Pick up your phone. Put down your coffee.
Sorry. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And my question is my hamstrings. I have very, very tight hamstrings. And I guess I'd like to get some ideas on the best way to stretch them. And is it also, should you pre-stretch before physical activity or do it afterwards for the hamstring?
Well, that's a good question. What kind of activities do you like to do?
Well, I like to walk, and I was a runner at one time, but I classify myself now as a jogger because I'm no longer, you know, but I'd like to kind of start that again just to do something different. We do a lot of cycling, my wife and I, and we enjoy that, but I really have tight hamstrings.
All right. Well, typically, we try to incorporate some stretching throughout the day into your daily activities so that they continuously get this message to be looser rather than just, you know, once at the end of the day. So if you're sitting, if you have a job that requires you to sit, putting one of your legs out on an open drawer or a stool or some other piece of furniture, and just sitting with your leg out straight where you feel a gentle stretch, not a lot of stretch, and sitting in that position for a few minutes as part of your daily routine works well. Before you get out of bed in the morning, you know, raising your leg straight up and kind of gently bending and straightening your knee. If you're out walking, incorporating some long striding so that you have a dynamic stretch to your hamstring is useful. So the idea would be that if you think about your daily routine and your activities, anything you can do to incorporate either a static or dynamic lengthening to your hamstrings will give you the most return over time.
Okay. And will they eventually get more flexible or get looser? I mean, can you actually do that?
Well, you can. You know, there's research that shows that you can. So you're getting into the technicalities, and I'll try to be brief. There are acute and long-term effects of stretching. So the acute stretching is when you warm up prior to an activity and you take your hamstring like a rubber band and you stretch it a little bit and you kind of loosen the bonds and the muscle and tendon. Then when you're done, it goes back to its original length. Then there's chronic effects of stretching where if you continue to provide that tension to your hamstring or to that muscle for longer periods of time, you can actually add length onto the tendon. And what's the dosage or amount of time required to do that? We're not exactly sure. We know about that from research where they've done lengthening studies where they actually cast people in a lengthened position to actually lengthen the muscle in the cases of things like cerebral palsy. So the idea is to do your best without making yourself crazy and see how far you can get.
Yeah, Ron, I've had a little bit of luck kind of indirectly. Besides the stretching the hamstrings directly, if stretching the calf muscles, the classic runner stretch, and then stretching deep hip rotators and hip joints, so kind of stretching above and below the hamstrings. Mm-hmm. So the classic runner stretch for your calf, and then for the hip, if you lie on your back, pull your left knee up toward your chest, pull your right knee up, grab the right knee with your right hand, grab your right foot with your left hand, and that adds a twist or rotation to the hip, and then pull with both hands up toward the opposite shoulder. And you should feel a deep stretch in the buttock area. And that kind of gets the area where the hamstrings attach up at the pelvis. Same principles of stretching as Lori talked about. You don't want to do it ballistically, more slow, sustained stretch, but also stretch above and below the hamstrings. That may help a little bit.
Thanks for that call, Ron. And you can join the conversation with physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault by calling 1-800-642-1234. Lots more to talk about with them. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We'll be back after this look at the news. It's great to exercise and be active, but no matter our age, there are precautions we need to take. Without attention to safety, a wrong turn or overuse of joints and muscles can lead to aches and pains or even worse. But with the right care at the right time, an injury doesn't need to hinder you permanently. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today about how to keep our bodies free of aches and pains that can slow us down. Our guests are physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Bill Boisenault. They're here for the next half hour to answer your questions. Do you have a recurring injury that you just can't seem to get past, or something new that's cropped up just in the last few weeks or so? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. And be sure to visit our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you like the page while you're there, you'll get daily updates on upcoming show topics. Lots more to talk about with Bill and Lori. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Nothing can ruin being active than a sore back or painful muscles. Once a month, we're fortunate to have folks with us who know a lot about staying in good shape and getting back in shape after an injury. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the graduate program director for the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Thanks again for being with us, Lori.
You bet. It's good to be here.
And Bill Boisenault is a full professor. We just found out. Congratulations.
Yay.
On that.
Thank
full,
you.
Full professor in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and senior physical therapist at the Spine Center Physical Therapy Clinic of the UW Hospitals and Clinics. Always a pleasure, Bill.
Thank you, Judith. Great to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's always great to talk about things that might be catching people's eyes, and we've been talking about the Olympics a lot. One of the things that just came up in one of the last calls, and I think is good to talk about, is the idea of stretching. I think often we talk about should we stretch before or after, but it sounds like maybe before and after is the way to go.
Oh, it really depends upon the activity.
Okay.
There's the conventional wisdom is you stretch as warm up. And that's not true for everybody anymore. So, first of all, if you're tight, if you have any kind of pathology or injury, should go by the recommendations of your healthcare professional. So if they say you should stretch beforehand, stretch. Typically, you should warm up before most activities. So all that being said, for people who are in dynamic sports, such as
jumping, basketball, soccer, football, those things that require dynamic plyometric types of activity. Stretching beforehand, particularly the calf muscles and things like that, can actually decrease performance. Mm. So that's not to be used as an excuse not to stretch if you should stretch, but stretching, you know, as sort of the carte blanche, I always stretch before my exercise routine may not be right. And I expect there are a fair number of Olympic athletes who did not stretch prior to their Olympic event. Anything involving speed, sprinting, jumping, you can decrease your performance if you stretch immediately prior to that activity.
Right. Well, and it also sounds like part of the key is before you warm up. And so you don't want to go from being totally cold to, you know, flat out sprinting or something like that either.
Right. Exactly. It depends upon what you're doing. So for me, if I'm going out for a jog, I don't stretch because I don't go that fast. So for
your
me,
jog
the jog
warm-up.
Is my warm up. Yeah. So, but I'll stretch afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Same here as well. Get warmed up, break a sweat a little bit, and then I can get a better stretch impact or effect.
Yeah, right. You don't want to stretch a cold muscle.
Right. All right. Let's go back to the phone. Mike in Medford has been waiting patiently. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, what would you do? I was diagnosed recently with basal joint arthritis. What could I do for exercises for that?
Which joint was that?
The right thumb joint.
Oh, the right thumb.
The first MCP articulation.
Yep. And you're right-handed, I presume?
It has to be that way, doesn't it?
Of course.
It does, of course.
Of course, yes.
Well,
yes.
You know, when you think about joints that get arthritis, you know, you think people tend to think hip and knee, but really that joint of your thumb is one of the main areas that people develop arthritis also, particularly if you use your hands a lot for a living. Also, people can get an injury called a skier's thumb where they sprain a ligament at the base of their thumb. And sometimes I think it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal because if it's not treated right, you can go on to develop arthritis in that joint and it's very debilitating. So, you know, the keys would be getting ergonomic tools that fit your hand and reduce the stress on that joint. You want to minimize the loads on that joint. There are splints you can wear. Have you been referred to therapy for that?
No, but I have an ergonomic keyboard and a mouse for my keyboard that's ergonomic.
Okay.
But the problem is they're talking about FCR with a graft in there.
Right. Right.
How does arthritis eat away at the bone?
Well, the bone, like the ends of a chicken bone, have that smooth, glossy articular cartilage. And when you wear away the articular cartilage, then you're down to bone. The articular cartilage itself doesn't have a lot of nerve supply in it. So a lot of times people don't develop a whole lot of pain until they get down to bone. So you may have heard the expression, oh, I'm bone on bone. And that means that the articular cartilage is gone on the bone on both sides of that joint. And then it hurts. So really, this is an issue of your pain and your symptoms. When the bad days are winning, you go to an intervention to try to help that. In the meantime, if you seek a referral to therapy, and there are hand specialists that specialize in this kind of thing, they can help you with some strategies to manage.
Okay.
So if you haven't, I understand you've done some things about your keyboard, but there's a whole host of other things that they can do to try to help you, and you can see how far that gets you and whether or not then that's an acceptable lifestyle for you.
Yeah, it just came on all of a sudden, and all of a sudden it's a mess.
Yeah. So they can help you get things back under control. And honestly, the arthritis didn't come on that fast, did it? I mean, that arthritis came on gradually. So something tipped the scales to become symptomatic. And it's not unreasonable to think that some therapy and some modifications of what you're doing might get you back to where you were before, at least for a while again.
They just said it's from old age and wear and tear.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the fact is it's there for you. And, you know, that joint we use all the time for daily activities. So you need a hand specialist should be able to help you in lots of different ways, Mike.
It's interfering with ADLs.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Mike. And let's go to Christy in Wausau next. Hi, Christy.
Hi. I had an MRI of my knee, and that was back in January, and the impression, I'm reading it now, is MR signs of patellar maltracking with quadriceps tendinopathy, edema of superolateral Hoffa's fat pad, and low-grade patellar chondromalacia. All they told me is just to take it easy with the knees, avoid squatting, and it has improved. But the other thing the doctor mentioned, she said I could do it on my own, but she really didn't give me details. She said to use weights on the ankles and do leg raises to improve the off-tracking.
Yeah, I would say to get some help with that.
Okay.
So there are ways to strengthen your quadriceps, and your doctor's absolutely right that strengthening your quadriceps will help this problem. But there are ways to strengthen them that will make you a whole lot worse,
yes.
And then ways to strengthen them that can help you be better. So, you know, there are some things that are pretty straightforward, but this is not one of them. And it depends upon where on the undersurface of your kneecap you have that patellar chondromalacia they talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the physical therapist can help design the exercises so that you don't, we call engage that lesion during the exercise session so that you can strengthen it without making your knee worse.
And what is that term off-tracking?
Well, when you bend and straighten your knee, you know, your kneecap glides mm-hmm. through a little groove on the end of the femur bone. And maltracking is when muscles that are either weak or tight, or actually we find now that much of that comes from hip muscle weakness, right. Not really weakness around the knee, causes that thing like a train to be slightly off track, or your wheels, your tires on your car to be slightly off track, and so then it wears funny. It's kind of what happens to your kneecap. So it really takes a good examination to find out the cause of the maltracking, and which is why going in to see somebody who will also examine your hip and your feet.
And the foot and ankle mm-hmm. as well. Yes.
Yeah, exactly, Bill.
So it's the whole system.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
I do have osteopenia in
yeah.
both hips.
Right. Okay. Well, that also is another reason why you should get some good guidance in
okay.
this exercise program.
So go to a physical therapist then.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you so much.
You
Thanks
bet, Christy.
For that call, Christy. And let's go right to Lauren in Madison next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just going to apologize. We have two little ones at home right now,
yeah.
So you're going to hear them in the background. But my question is, I am a distance swimmer, and when I got pregnant with my first, I ended up with a pubic diastasis and a lot of hip and pelvic issues. Went to physical therapy, and it did get better, and I ended up getting it again with my second. And now I'm at the point where it's only aggravated by sleeping, and I'm a side sleeper, and there's just a lot of popping, a lot of adjusting that happens while I'm sleeping in my hips and pelvis. My question is two-part, is what can I do sleeping-wise position to help this, and is swimming aggravating this in any way?
So, Lauren, when you say the diastasis, is it the pubic symphysis, or is it in the
yes.
abdominal muscle itself?
No, nope, pubic symphysis.
Okay, so you're getting some widening at the pubic symphysis.
Yeah, and a lot of SI joint and pubic symphysis adjusting while I'm sleeping.
Okay, all right. Yeah, it's all part of the pelvic ring. Are there certain positions that are painful, difficult for you, or is it changing position when you move in bed?
Yeah, it's rolling from side to side. When I'm going from one side to the other, that's where the popping will happen.
Yeah.
And it is uncomfortable just while I'm sleeping.
Okay. All right. Well, a couple things standard in terms of once you get settled into a position, you know, if you're a side sleeper, my guess is you probably have already tried this, a pillow or two between the knees and maybe a pillow underneath your top arm, kind of hug that pillow to keep your pelvis and spine in more of a neutral position. That can help there. For the transitional movements, changing positions in bed, that's more of a challenge because, you know, you're either asleep or three quarters asleep. And so it's difficult to set your glutes and abdominals and then roll and change positions. Do you have an SI joint belt that you've been given along the way?
I do. And, you know, I haven't been faithful with using it lately. I did after having our first, I did use it a little bit, and it did give me relief during the day. But at this point, I don't have any discomfort during the day. It's really just sleeping
more
at night.
Well, yeah. I don't know. There are different kinds of belts, but maybe try wearing the belt at night. And don't snug it up super tight, but just somewhat snug, and see if that allows you to change positions during the night without as much, and maybe eliminate the popping. It'll just stabilize the pelvis a bit. So between the pillows with the positioning, maybe try the belt and see if that helps you with the movements at night.
Okay. Swimming doesn't make this worse or make me more prone to having these sort of issues?
Well, it's possible. I mean, certainly it stresses. Depending what type of kick you're doing, it can really stress the pubic symphysis and the SI joints. I would try changing one thing at a time. Maybe try wearing the belt at night and see if that helps. But having said, even with the swimming, doing some core, some core work, so the muscles can be giving you more and more support during the swimming as well as other daily activities. So are you doing any kind of core work right now?
No.
Okay. Well, you're taking care of children, so I understand you're getting exercise.
If I can get in the swimming, I'm happy.
Yes, yeah, and I understand. But some things, yoga at times, Tai Chi for balance, and, getting in a little bit of core work where you can, it may help as well.
Yeah, you can try. There are a lot of good videos that you can do at home, in 10 or 15 minutes and do a core workout, and I think it's, sometimes holding a baby can be part of the workout.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that call, Lauren, and good luck with that. Let's actually stay on the motherhood train here. Cindy from Plover emailed, "Before I was pregnant, I worked out 5 days a week with a personal trainer doing light cardio and strength training. Once pregnant, I was so ill that I was in bed and barely moving for 8 weeks. Now that I'm feeling better at 20 weeks pregnant, I'm wanting to start exercising again, but I'm dealing with some low back muscle pain and spasms, and all of my joints are feeling very loose, especially hips and shoulders. It's my second pregnancy, but I'm not sure where I should start with exercise."
Well, for someone at 20 weeks and having potentially some joint instability, maybe from increased levels of relaxin and things like that, the pool is a great place to start exercising because you have limited weight bearing. So if you do have a little bit of hypermobility around your joints, it isn't going to manifest as much. So that's a good place to start where you can do some strengthening and some cardio work. And especially if you're having low back problems, the buoyancy of the water will support that baby in front and take some of the strain off of your back. So that's probably where I would start with exercise and then see how far she gets.
I mean, it's also good because she can increase speed or resistance,
right?
But still have that support.
Right. Exactly.
And may end up tolerating a land-based program down the road, mm-hmm. maybe. Mm-hmm. But this would be the safest medium to start
with. And it's going to just make her feel a lot better for the end of her pregnancy. The hydrostatic pressure of the water will help with any swelling that she tends to get in her ankles. And she's just going to be overall feel more fit as she goes into that delivery and postpartum period.
Great. Thanks for that email, Cindy. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking with physical therapists Lori Tyne-Brody and Bill Boisenault. And let's go back to the phones and Ellen in Big Bend. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Last January and March, I had carpal tunnel on both my hands. And since then, I wake up in the morning, I have really stiff fingers. I have to just take one hand and push them together to make a fist. But, through the day, they get along all right. Is that a result of the surgery or is something else going on?
Well, it could be a result of the surgery. So it was in January, March of this year, 2012?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Are you doing any kind of exercising for your wrists and hands and arms?
Just normal daily activities.
Okay.
Nothing special, no.
All right. Well, the surgery is designed to take pressure off the median nerve that innervates muscles and skin down into our hand and thumb area. You get scar tissue from the surgery itself. And so there are certain types of stretches, not only for the tendons, but also for the median nerve to help promote it gliding through the tunnel. And, you know, again, I would think, you know, one visit, a couple of visits with a physical therapist, they can examine you and give you the right types of stretches to do. It may be, you probably wore splints at night in the past before the surgery, but it may be some splints in the beginning here. It may help with some of the tissue extensibility. But it's stretching not only at your wrists, but also a combination of wrist and hand up through your shoulder and neck. To work on the gliding of the median nerve and the tendons as well.
Well, the pain is gone. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So well, good. I'm hopefully you've got sensation back and strength back. But
yes, me too.
But if you know there's scar tissue in there, it serves a purpose. But you want it to be extensible, and you're at a stage where you should be able to start stretching. And again, one or two visits, but all the therapists need to set you up on a good program you can do on your own.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. And let's go to Donna in Cedarburg next. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently went to the doctor because I had some popping in the back of my neck when I'd turn my head and stuff. And they took x-rays and the nurse or someone called back and said that I have moderate degenerative joint disease. And they said if I ever get numbness in my hand or arm, I should call them. Which makes it sound like there's nothing you could do about it. What do you suggest?
Well, I'm glad you called. The popping is not unusual when we start getting some arthritic changes. You get some rough joint surfaces, just like we get at our kneecap. Sometimes areas get roughened and you squat, your knees pop and crack a little bit. You want to promote as good as flexibility as you can in the upper back and shoulder area, along with the neck, so that when you do move your head and neck, you don't necessarily reach the end of your range of motion at the neck. Posture is very important, and then also strengthening. So it's kind of our usual combination of you want flexibility at the area where the arthritic changes have occurred, but also above and below it, and then strengthening and postural training on top of that. And a lot of that you can do on your own. Again, a physical therapist can teach you lots of different ways to do the different stretches, to do the appropriate stretching, can work with you on your posture, the things you do during the course of your day. So the arthritic changes are probably going on for quite a while, but if it shows up on an x-ray, it's been going on for quite a while, probably at times when you've not had any symptoms at all. So you just need to try to compensate for the changes that have occurred. So again, I think a physical therapist can examine you and within a visit or two give you an idea of how much they can help, but certainly teach you to do a number of these things on your own.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thanks for that call, Donna. And let's take a quick call from Kathy in Hubertus. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a, I think it's a tendon problem. It's like it's deep in the muscle of my right arm, and it's on the inner aspect. Not like tennis elbow, but, you know, more in. And I don't really know how to, like with tennis elbow, you have that round strap you use to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do to protect this or to help it.
How did it start?
I don't know. I don't think I did anything that I remember.
Okay. Is it on the inside of your elbow or is it in your forearm or upper arm?
Forearm.
It is down in your forearm.
Right.
So it's not up at your elbow.
It's not that far up, no.
Okay. And
it's
if
like
you...
about an inch below where you draw blood.
Okay. But it's in the front?
And if I put my hand out where, you know, like if someone was going to draw blood, it's just down like an inch or so in that muscle.
Okay. It could be an insertional tendonitis from there are a number of upper arm muscles, your biceps and brachialis, a bunch of upper arm muscles that attach in there. So it makes me wonder if you've had some kind of overuse thing where you were bending and straightening your elbow or turning your palm up and down. Can create that. I'd go in and have it looked at because it's a relatively unusual problem. So you want to make sure that you get it diagnosed properly so that you get the right intervention. I mean, I could tell you some exercises you could do to strengthen those muscles, but again, it's not a very common problem, and I would be reluctant to tell you some things to do in the absence of a more definitive diagnosis.
Okay. All right.
Does that make sense? Okay.
All right. And a very quick question on Facebook. What's your opinion of kinesio tape? I broke my ankle in three places, put together with a plate and seven screws. After almost 2 years, it still gets stiff and sore after exercising. Would the tape help? That's from Chris in Lake Geneva.
Well, kinesio tape is a kind of a stretchy supportive tape that people use in a lot of different areas to give support to the muscles. You know, given his history of the fracture and plates, I don't see that this has a big indication for use in this category. I'd say if he's getting stiff and sore on the elliptical, it's because of too much weight bearing. And I'd probably be more inclined to go to a modification of his activities, looking at how much range he has. If he has a plate and screws and stuff, chances are he's got limited range, and so he's placing a lot of load over a small area of his ankle and maybe wearing out his ankle.
Yeah, there's probably no downside unless he gets an allergic skin reaction, but I would agree with Lori with sounds like the nature of the injury and the surgery. Probably not going to help a lot.
Okay. I notice a lot of the athletes in the Olympics with some really interesting taping
patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of that is kinesio tape. And, you know, that was probably used therapeutically. And at some point, it became attached to
right.
it. You know, it's part of the ritual.
Well, as usual, lots of great information shared. And Bill and Lori are here on the third Mondays of the month. But next time, Bill will be off and Jill Nissenbaum will be joining Lori. Thanks so much to both of you for being here.
Pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.